from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll talk with Bob Harbin about his upcoming production of Cabaret.
I'll get a preview of the Gregory Hancock Dance Theater's production of The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
And I'll find out why the Humanities Council is feeling so competitive. Plus, there'll be our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. In the sexy musical Cabaret, it's 1931 in Berlin. As the Nazis are rising to power and nightlife at the seedy Kit Kat Club revolves around the 19-year-old English cabaret performer Sally Bowles and her relationship with the young American writer Cliff Bradshaw. Might as well live life in a big way since you don't know what tomorrow will bring. Sharon Gamble invited director Bob Harbin into our studios to tell us why he's staging Cabaret this summer and why he's departing from family-friendlier programming.
This is not theater for kids. I'm just going to state the obvious.
You are so correct. although I must admit, I have been watching some primetime television just to get a sense
of what kids are seeing.
Exactly. And whoa. that CW. Whoa. Other than the fact that, yes, it has some very somber overtones. We are talking about pre-World War II.
Right.
We are talking about Germany, just about the time that the Nazis are starting to gain some popularity and taking over, the country.
And for people who are a little fuzzy on their history, this is about 1930-31 when
yes,
this
1931.
Happens.
Yes, mm-hmm. 1931. And I believe Hitler came in 33, close to 34. So it's some somber subject matter in that respect, and the musical certainly does deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
I have so much respect for musicals that are out there that don't shy away from important topics. It's all great to have our candy and sing while we do it, but I think it's also so brave and wonderful that people do musicals about important subject matter as well.
What's your mission?
With this particular show?
And in general, because I know this fits within the broader mission of your theater company.
There are many people who live in Indianapolis by choice, and that's certainly a wonderful thing. Some people who live in Indianapolis, not necessarily by choice, but they're here.
Mm-hmm.
And although we're not necessarily known as a theater town, I think it's important that we have the opportunity to see different kinds of theater, to see things that aren't just presented one way that we're used to, that we're accustomed to.
Mm-hmm.
I so give kudos to Brian at the Phoenix, because what he does there, I think, is amazingly important to our city. And it may not be for you. You may not, go there all the time. But I think it's so terrific just to have the opportunity to see something a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And so... I think this musical lends itself to really being able to identify with a time, with a place, and with an attitude of a people that is not that dissimilar to what we're going through right now in our, lovely United States.
How do you figure?
We have economic problems right now that have become so important that many people voted as the number one issue when it comes to the upcoming election. And that's exactly what 1931 Germany was going through as well. very difficult times. How will we survive? There are no jobs. What can I, you know, what kind of job can I possibly get? And there's certainly people in this show that have jobs that aren't jobs of their choice. And here comes a man who understood that about his people, brought them an economic solution, and unfortunately, it just was very wrong.
You know? Boy, that's an understatement.
However, part of his drive was to solve this problem,
sure.
Which I think speaks to us how important it is to get out there, and you don't have to carry a placard or march in a parade, but know what's going on politically. Know what you're voting about and voting for.
There you go.
And be so aware of what's going on in your neighborhood and in your city and in your state and in your nation.
There was a fairly popular film some number of years ago in which Kevin Klein played the American president.
Yes.
Great line from it. In the absence of leadership, people will follow whoever steps up to the microphone.
Brilliant.
And that's what happened.
Absolutely.
And that's
true.
What's happening in Cabaret.
Absolutely true. We as a cast, we're always, you know, it's, you know, lest we forget has become a big phrase for us. And also, the wonderful, and I'm going to forget it now. If you forget, you're destined to repeat.
Yeah, those who forget history are destined to repeat it.
Thank you so much. And it's all true. We have to so pay attention. And we think, oh, it's impossible. You know, hard to say.
Mm. Speaking of history, how do you get beyond as director, producer, leader of your cast, how do you get beyond the super, super popular Liza Minnelli, Michael York, Joel Grey film version of Cabaret from the early 70s? I mean, that kind of made such an enormous mark, and it's hard to find somebody who's involved in musical theater today who hasn't seen that. How do you get people to set aside that vision and pursue their own, your own vision?
Well, I think that the last thing you want to do is try to imitate it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think many productions do. And it's not a question of whether they succeed or they fail. I just think they always come up a little short because that particular interpretation was so brilliantly done. And my goodness, the film won, 7 or 8, I think, Academy Awards, all well-deserved. And it's a brilliant piece of filmmaking. So our step number one is to get away from it as much as possible,
mm-hmm.
from the very top of the show, and not in any way proceed to copy that piece. We don't have Eliza Minnelli, and that was never my intention. We have the incredible Claire Wiltshire, who's playing Sally, and she doesn't look like Liza Minnelli at all, but she has an amazing voice. She's amazingly talented, and our MC will not look or dress or sound like Joel Grey. We will take a much edgier point of view for the piece. We will take a much more real approach. When you think of the Kit Kat Club, it's this dive, in Berlin. In economic troubles. So what you're seeing on the stage is not something you would see at, the Folies Bergère, in Paris. This is down in dirty Berlin.
It's going to be seedy.
Pardon me?
It's going to be seedy.
Oh, yes, which is another reason why it's maybe not necessarily, appropriate for our young children. But it's going to be very realistic and very true, hopefully, to what was going on at the time.
This musical is a lot about prejudice.
Yes, yes.
And stereotypes.
Yes.
How do you convey those? I can't think of a synonym for the M word, so I'm going to say it, messages, without being heavy-handed.
I think part of that genius is in the writing of the piece. I think that We have taken certainly a more honest look at some of the music, but the music is amazing. You cannot. It's uplifting. It's fun. It's funny.
Yeah.
It's exciting, and that music always keeps you, I think, excuse me, up in the air and having a you know, elevated soulfully. And I think that few times do you accomplish your goal if you become too heavy-handed. So I think that you will be able to tell how we feel and how they felt when they wrote this piece without having been preached to. The references are many, but they are subliminal many times. And I have tried to approach this piece as sort of almost like a puppet piece, where all of these people could be Muppets and presenting a story, whereas you still enjoy the people that you're watching. There's one bad guy that I don't care if you enjoy him or not.
Now, there's a difference between enjoying the performance and
absolutely,
it's always fun to see friends come off stage and having played the bad guy, and
yes,
you tell them how much you hated them, and you have to explain that it's a compliment.
Well, you know what's difficult in this piece, quite honestly, is that this is 1931. Some of the real horrors happened after that. We all know the ending. We all know what became of many of these kind of people, of the people of Germany. We're aware,
that's right,
of the ending.
But the characters don't know.
It's like going to see Titanic. Hey, guess what? The boat goes down. So we know. So it's also, we have to keep in mind all of the time not to play these people with the knowledge that we have, but to play them as they would have been, you know, before.
And there's a very clever device in that there's a little bit of a remove in that some of your characters are Brits who are in Berlin.
They are two leads. We are going to be Americans in Berlin.
Oh, smart.
And but same
truth idea.
Be said.
Yeah.
That it is sort of one is completely new to the area, so everything he sees and hears is new to him. And of course, and Sally's been there; she's been performing in this club, so she's kind of chosen a let's all get along kind of attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And they contrast, and eventually, of course, separate because of that difference of attitude.
Favorite moment in the musical? Knowing that this may evolve as we're having this conversation, you're rehearsing,
yes.
You're not, you haven't opened yet.
Fräulein Schneider, who is played, Mickey Mathiodakis is playing Fräulein Schneider, and she talks about how noble it is to think that the best thing would be to stand up to this man, to this leader, stand up to the situation, move, get out of the way of it. And yet, at her age and her economic situation, she feels as if she does not have a choice but to stay there and to take care of herself and to stay in her boarding house. And she explains it in a beautiful song called What Would You Do? But at the end of the song, she says to both Sally and Cliff, I regret everything. And that it seals it for me.
Sharon Gamble with Bob Direct's producer and director Bob Harbin. You can see Cabaret on July 6th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, 20th, and 21st, with Thursday through Saturday performances at 7:30 and Sunday matinee at 3 o'clock. Learn more and get tickets at bobdirects.com. That's BOBDIREX.com, BobDirects.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. The Gregory Hancock Dance Theater is bringing back one of their most popular productions, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, with the two original stars, dancers Christine Thacker and Martin Casanova. Travis DiNicola spoke with Christine and Martin about the show's return.
Christine, Martin, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Great to see you both again.
Thank you. You too, Travis. Thank you so much.
Christine, it's been a little while since we've seen you. You've been, let me just make sure I got this straight. You did retire from dancing about 5 years ago.
Five years ago. I think we had
you on then.
Yes.
And now you're back out of retirement.
Yes.
Woo-hoo.
Yes.
Just can't keep you down.
I know. They keep pulling me back in. No. No, and it's really an honor because I retired and just kind of stopped dancing. Mm-hmm. I was doing some teaching. I had some children, and I was actually expecting my second child when Gregory notified me and said, hey. Next season, what you thinking about?
We're doing this again. Because, I mean, the Hunchback of Notre Dame, I mean, the two of you have done this before. And, I mean, you created these roles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so so Gregory was like, he really wanted you back.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, you know, Travis, that's a huge honor. You know, because it's not that he does not have a company of young, talented, amazing dancers to choose from. So it's a huge honor to be retired and retired 5 years and to be asked to come back to do this and to do this part again and to be trusted to be able to do it.
There must have been a little bit of trepidation or doubt there. You look terrific, and but I'm sure you were thinking, how quickly can I get back into dancer shape and performance shape, and after having two kids?
Yes. I've had two kids, and I have four children.
And to be clear, you are not playing Quasimodo.
No. There's been some debate about that.
Oh, I don't think
I kind
so.
Of felt like it today. But,
Even on your worst day.
Yeah,
please.
No, there was some trepidation, though, because there's a huge difference between being in concert dance shape and being in shape, and there's a huge difference between being 35 and not 35, or being 25, or, you know, I mean, I'm twice as old as a lot of the dancers that are in the company, and I was 5 years out of shape. And initially, he wanted to do it in October. We changed plans a little bit, and I had my last child in April. So I did dance with the company in October. We did a preview.
Wow, okay.
So I was back on the Marley just a couple months after I had my last baby, getting into shape. And I was with the company in October, and then we're doing the full production.
Now. Well, you look great.
And thanks. If I might add, it's like she never left. She looks impeccable.
Thank you.
Impeccable.
Thank you.
So, Martin, how fun is this for you to have her come back?
Oh, my gosh. I'm ecstatic. I can't even explain.
Yeah.
It's when she first came back to work, we were just talking about it, how it's like we never left each other. So it's like having my sister or my aunt back, you know, so it's just really
And you have
fabulous.
Not retired.
Not yet, no. No,
no
I have
no,
not.
No.
He's a youngin.
No, no, no.
Hopefully I have a few more years left in me.
You certainly do.
So tell me about Hunchback. Because this has become sort of a signature piece for Gregory Hancock Dance Theater and also for the work that the two of you have done. He's performed it before. I'm not sure when the first time was. It's over 10 years ago?
2005
okay.
was the first one.
Okay.
This was the first time.
Okay.
Yeah.
So more recent than that, but 2005 was when it was created. Tell me about the piece, because it's a great story and a great choreography that's been put together. And Martin, even though I was joking about Christine being Quasimodo, you are actually Quasimodo.
Yes, I am. Yes.
And I know this is a really difficult role.
It is very difficult on many different levels, not to mention physically, not just the dancing, but I also have to take on some very difficult physical characterization, as well as the emotional content of the show, is very, very trying, to say the least. Especially, you have to kind of really disconnect in rehearsal sometimes just to keep your sanity afloat. But the Hunchback is one of Gregory's favorite piece, and he has managed to intertwine many, many different themes through the piece that it, you know, actually lends itself to very naturally. You know, religion. Social construct, Christine.
Yeah, my thing about the Hunchback of Notre Dame is that it's an epic ballet, and that's the best way to describe it. It is like going to see, you know, your favorite epic movie. It's just transforming. And even if you don't like dance, this is a concert that you would enjoy. The music is phenomenal. The staging and dancing is phenomenal. The costumes are fantastic. The set is fantastic. The storyline is fantastic. You don't have to be a lover of dance to enjoy this production. And, you know, my favorite thing is that
after we're done, I'll go out in the house, and I always stay and talk to people. And I love the women that come up to me, and they whisper, "My husband was crying," because there's something for everyone in this.
I mean, it's a tragic, dark story.
It's a tragic, dark story. It's not
Hugo's
the Disney version.
Original book is a very dark book.
Yes,
and that's really the inspiration for this.
Yes,
is that not the Disney version?
It has a lot of
the Disney version.
Oh no, no.
Do not bring your 5-year-old.
It has a lot of social commentary, and what I think is so timeless and beautiful about it is that it still resonates accurately today, as far as what money can buy you, in our society, sometimes with some people that buy Lawyers of a Dream Team. You know, this is someone who's Esmeralda is put on trial for the murder of someone who wasn't even killed.
Who's there at her execution. Standing there alive.
And no one cares, and that's the irony of it. It's just because, they're the bottom of society, and she doesn't have any place to turn, and Esmeralda and Quasimodo find each other and make a connection, the only human connection the two of them have. They're both orphans, essentially, is what it boils down to, and they find that connection and this love together.
And to be clear, this is a dance piece. I mean, they're much more like a sort of a modern ballet dance theater, but there are no lines, right, that are spoken. I mean, this is all done in dance.
Correct. Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. There is some tracked dialogue that are part of the musical tracks, but everything is danced. The story, one of the things that Gregory does so beautifully is his masterful storytelling through music, through dance, through costume, through lighting. Mm-hmm. Our brilliant lighting director, Ryan Kaharchik, I don't know how he does it. I mean, it's absolutely, you have to come see this.
If
you don't do anything else this summer, you have to come see The Hunchback of Notre Dame, because it is just a feast for the senses. Costumes,
and all
lighting.
Set in Paris, and that sort
yes.
of...
Yes, yeah, before she became the City of Lights.
Right.
Yes, there was the
very dark
and dismal.
It's very dark.
Yeah.
It's very dark. There's stabbings, there's intrigue, there's romance, whatever you want.
Everything, yes.
Maureen, let me ask you about dancing this role, because you are the hunchback, but you can't really dance with a hunched back, right? I mean, so how do you take that on?
Well, at times I do.
At times you do.
Yeah. Well, pretty much I do.
Do?
I mean, because when we were first
that's the part to me that's so physically demanding here for
it,
you. It's amazing.
It is. I mean, it's I'm trying to make it better. You know, one of the great things when you get to revisit roles is, oh my gosh, it's such a privilege to come back to this. How can I make it better?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I'm working on right now, is how to make it a little bit more real. How am I, if I was a deformed person, if Victor Hugo was seeing me do this, would he be happy with this? That's kind of what I'm always thinking about.
Martin's extremely modest, and I'll toot his horn for him, because the role that he dances is physically demanding as a dancer, standing upright and working as, you would as a dancer is trained. And he does all of that, and he transforms his body, literally physically transforms his body and his face. It's not just in his back and in his posture and his stance and how he has to move. He holds his face a certain way for 2 hours and dances and never ever breaks character. And not only, is it, athletically challenging, but then he also...
Well, as you said, I mean, very emotionally challenging,
It's extremely
too.
Emotionally challenging.
How do you prepare for something like that?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I really just try to be in every single moment. I do my research. I mean, when I first did it, the role, I researched a lot on, the mentally disabled, because essentially Quasimodo was, not only physically deformed, but he was what we would call today maybe developmentally disabled. And he's also maybe 85% blind. I mean, he really can't see anything.
Yeah.
So that I taking all that into account. I got my start in musical theater.
Yeah.
I've really taken
You are an actor.
I really tried to harken back to that, and really just, thinking about, what all my teachers were telling me. And
I think that's what works well for Martin and I both, is that, for lack of a better word, we're method actors. And we do a lot of research, and we go there daily. And working together as a team, I think that's what's been so beautiful about it, is that we both come from it at the same artistic point of view, and we respect each other's artistry, and we give to each other's artistry, and there's really a bond that is just unusual to find. It's rare. If you find it once in a lifetime as an artist, to be able to have this kind of a connection with someone and to be able to perform it again.
Yeah, so to revisit it. I mean, you're very fortunate to have
that.
We are. And now at a new space, right?
Yes.
Here at Dynevor at the Tarkington, at up at the Center for the Performing Arts, which is a great theater. And so that's got to be exciting, too, to take this and recreate it, but in a totally new space for you.
Yes.
Very exciting, yes.
Yeah, it's like Gregory Hancock Dance Theater, High Def.
Yes.
That theater. it's amazing. We've had diehard fans that have come and seen other productions this year, like Superhero, which is another very emotional piece. Another fantastic vehicle for Martin's talents, and people who are just diehard fans, and they've asked me afterwards, like, well, did Gregory add something? It was different this time. I was like, no, it's just because the theater is fantastic.
You're seeing things that you never saw before, right?
Yeah.
Well, very exciting. I wish you both the best. Looking forward to it very much. Hunchback of Notre Dame. Martin and Christine, thank you so much for coming in today, and again, to see you again, and best of luck.
Thank you.
Thank you, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with dancers Christine Thacker and Martin Casanova. The Gregory Hancock Dance Theater's production of The Hunchback of Notre Dame will take place on June 29th and 30th at the Tarkington Theater at the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel. You can get more information at GregoryHancockDanceTheater.org. Theater is spelled with an R-E at the end. So again, GregoryHancockDanceTheater.org.
Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
It is now officially summer.
It's so true, although it's been summer weather for weeks.
I know, but this is the point where the days start actually getting shorter, even though it doesn't quite feel like it.
Oh, don't remind
or
me.
Maybe
I have
it's
so
just
many
narrower.
Things to do. Narrower days. That's so cute.
Well, so many things that we can do that we will talk about on that calendar that we call...
What'll we do for the official summer?
Yes. Now, I know that lots of people are wondering, how did I do in croquet?
I'm very curious about croquet, which is not to be confused with how you did with croquettes.
No.
That's another story.
Last weekend was the President Benjamin Harrison Holmes Wicked World of Croquet Day, which included the tournament, which some listeners may remember that I am the returning champion for with my partner, Sally Zalonis. Sally and I won the tournament in 2011.
Is there like a ribbon or a medal that goes
with that?
There's a cup.
A beautiful silver cup.
Uh-huh.
And so this year we competed again against 40 other teams, and we made it to the finals after blowing through, doing very well in our first six games. And we lost in the finals, and so we came in second. We were first runner-up this year. But I have to tell you, Sharon, that perhaps the most amusing, though it wasn't at the time, moment for me came when, during the middle of the finals, a small child walked up to me and said, and this was right after I just missed a really easy shot, a little child came up to me and said, "What do we do?
No way.
Miss the wicket?"
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
No. Some parent prepared that child for
And
that.
I looked at him and told him to get off the court. So, anyways, we'll see what happens next year. But back to our other events that we have going on.
There is no skill in croquet required for our calendar that we call What'll We Do?
Yeah,
oh, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was pretty rough.
I am so sorry.
Okay. So what do you have going on?
Well, you know, nothing says summer like the vroom, vroom, vroom of a motorcycle. And if you haven't been, or even if you've been and you just want to go take it all in again to the Eideldorf to see Steel Ponies, I remind you, your time is running short. You just have a few weeks left. It's only there through August 5th. Make a special point of checking out I'm going to use the word educational, but don't tell the kids I said that. All the materials that tell you about interesting things, including the evolution of engines, the particular place of women in motorcycle history, in particular in the early years. So, you'll sneak some education into the kids when you go to the Eideldorf to see Steel Ponies. You can get more information about hours and special programming at eideldorf.org.
Very cool. Hey, just want to welcome a whole bunch of art educators who are going to be in town this week. They are participating in the International Society for Education Through Art and the United States Society for Education Through Art. They are holding their 2012 conference, Education Through Art. You got the theme here. Teaching for Global Understanding and Engagement. In part, it's sponsored through IU, and they are supporting it. And the conference is taking place all this week and downtown Indianapolis. So if you see a lot of art educators walking around,
how
say
will
hello.
We know them?
They'll be the creative ones.
I see. Yeah. Okay. it was kind of a wiseacre
this
question.
It's not like
I
Gen
realized.
Con, though.
No.
They don't dress up in costumes. Which,
not
by
that
the way,
there's
is
anything
back
wrong
in
with
August.
That.
Yes.
And in conjunction, the weekend of July, closest to July 4th. Anyway, the Indianapolis Early Music Festival, as you heard in Travis's interview recently, has come back for another year, another season. This first weekend, you can hear Ingrid Matthews with Byron Schenkman tomorrow. That's June 24th at the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana History Center. That's the Indianapolis Early Music Festival. Lots of great stuff still to come, including next weekend, Gut, Wind, and Wire.
That sounds like I love that. I love it.
Me too.
Isn't that awesome? Hey, this is very cool. Down at the Indy IMAX, the downtown Indy IMAX, they have a new liquor license, and they want to celebrate. So they are having an Indiana Taste of Downtown event with a whole bunch of local beers, including, of course, Sun King, and wines and coffees and concessions. Big free party going on this June 27th. So that is coming up in just a couple days, and it starts at 5 o'clock at the downtown IMAX, where the State Museum is, and this open house party is going to have live entertainment and free samples from Sun King and Just Pop In Popcorn and coffee and tea from Hubbard and Cravens and sweets from the Albanese Candy Company, and they're also going to be doing a showing of the film Atlanteans in America, which is a tale of a candy farmer who makes toffee under sea salt.
I'm sorry, a
toffee.
What?
In
a
underwater
candy?
City of Atlantis. Candy.
Farmer.
A candy farmer. It's a
oh, I get it. It's
farm-grown taffy. Yes.
Oh, and
yeah.
It's
yeah.
And
so they're showing that movie.
Salty ocean water.
There you go.
Okay.
So this is all coming up on Wednesday, June 27th. Again, starting after 5 o'clock down at the IMAX. Should be a ton of fun. Get more information at imaxindy.com.
I wish there really were candy farmers. That would be
cool.
So fun. this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, if you're listening to us Saturday afternoon, don't despair. There's more to go. The Indian Market and Festival taking place at the Idle Jorg. So much cool stuff
event.
To do there. Talk to the artists. Bring your kids, because there's kids' activities, hands-on activities. They'll learn about traditional craft-making techniques. And speaking of food and drink, there's food and drink. So what is not to love about the Indian Market and Festival at the Idle Jorg? Been going on for decades now. Go check it out.
Also coming up on Wednesday the 27th, down at the Heron School of Art and Design at their galleries in their area, they're having a panel discussion that marks the 50th anniversary of Art Glass in the United States. And this takes place at 7 p.m. again on Wednesday the 27th in the Basile Auditorium. And it's tied into the exhibit that they have right now, Indie Collects, which is on exhibit through the 26th of local Indianapolis art collectors and the work that they've both collected and created, which is very cool. Christopher West of Antique Helper and Judy Wells of the Indiana Glass Arts Alliance are putting this panel together, and it's also going to include Paula Katz from Heron, and should be a great time.
I love that.
Yeah, very, very cool. So again, this the 27th at 7 p.m. at the Basile Auditorium.
I love that.
If you like glass, go to this conversation.
Exactly. Hey, this is the weekend, remember, if you're up for a little road trip, of the 14th annual Brown County, Indiana Studio and Garden Tour. All this weekend, hours are Saturday from 9 to 6. If you are hearing us in Indianapolis on Saturday afternoon, it might be a little late, but you can go down tomorrow, that's Sunday, 10 to 5. And it is a wonderful kind of collaboration of many, many studios, and you can look at gardens, look at art, purchase art. You can get more information by simply walking to a computer and typing in browncountystudiotour.com. Brown County Studio and Garden Tour.
Since it is summer, Sharon, it's time to go out to Connor Prairie to see Symphony on the Prairie. And this weekend, Heroes and Victors, music from the greatest sports films of all time, including Rocky and Breaking Away and Hoosiers, Rudy, Field of Dreams, Chariots of Fire, The Natural, Ben-Hur. Never thought of Ben-Hur as a sports film, but why not? Among others.
Sure it is.
Sure
that's
it is.
Well, that's a competition.
Yeah.
Sure.
So they will be performing this weekend, and it's always great to go out to, of course, Symphony on the Prairie. Next weekend, they're going to be performing the music of Queen. That should be a lot of fun with the paying tribute to the fantastic, awesome rock band.
Speaking of camp, Dearest, the Mommy musical.
Uh-huh. Oh, there we go.
You see the connection, is on stage at Theater on the Square. This is Ron Spencer. I don't know how he continues to find inspiration. He has a tireless muse on his shoulder. He wrote the book, Music and Lyrics. And if you have ever been to Theater on the Square or read a little bit about Tots, you know its creator, Ron Spencer, has a real crush on a lot of the leading ladies of film noir back in the day. And this musical is actually based on the cult hit Mommy Dearest, which is a film about movie legend Joan Crawford. There's not too much more I can say about that on Family Radio. Just go to tots.org, tots.org, for more information about Dearest, the Mommy musical.
The last thing I got is the Irvington Guild of Artists is presenting Film Night, and this is coming up on Wednesday the 27th. What is it, Sharon, with Wednesday the 27th? There's so much going on that
night. It's the night before my birthday.
Everyone's celebrating. Happy birthday, Sharon.
Thank you.
Well, so they are, it's part of their Quirky Art World film series. And they are providing they're showing a documentary about a salty thrift store rummager purchasing a painting for under $10, later to find out that it's worth millions.
Ooh.
And this is taking place in Irvington. Always fun. Check out Lazy Days Coffee House to get more information. The movie itself is at the Irvington Public Library, and then the discussions afterwards all starts around, looks like 6:30 on Wednesday night.
Well, I'm just going to add one more item to Wednesday night, the 27th. It is a Kokomo Park Band concert. It's at 8 o'clock in Kokomo's Highland Park on Wednesday, the 27th. The theme, Spotlight on Youth. There will be a Purdue University conductor, as well as a high school student soloist competition winner and youth percussion workshop participants in a program of music from around the world. So think young at heart on Wednesday night in Kokomo.
And we will be back next week with more things on that calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
After digging into food over the last few years, the Indiana Humanities Council, now known as Indiana Humanities, is exploring new territory with the spirit of competition, a touring exhibition with programming that just launched. Sharon Gamble invited Indiana Humanities Program Director Brandon Judkins to our studio to challenge him to tell us more.
So where did the idea for the spirit of competition come from?
Well, at Indiana Humanities, our mission is to inspire Hoosiers to think, read, and talk. And that's a pretty broad, bold mission. And we have found that we are much more successful when we can anchor that in something tangible, something that people can sink their teeth into. And so for 2 years, we had a series of programs we called Food for Thought that was really, really successful and drew a lot of people in. And we really liked how that structure worked. So the beginning of this year, we moved to a new 2-year series of programs that we're calling Spirit of Competition.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good natural segue from the work we were doing before. And as we thought about things that are universal like food, the more we talked about it, the more we kept coming back to there's sort of nothing more universal than this notion of competition that you initially think of sports. But if you start to drill down, competition is a part of everything that we do. It's sports, it's business, but it's politics.
Society, yeah.
Social competition.
Yeah.
So it allowed us a really broad area to explore.
Most of our listeners will certainly know that Indianapolis went through a period under Mayor Hudnut where it was looking for a new identity, and part of that identity was to become the amateur sports capital of the world. But you're a statewide organization. Are there other kind of pockets of natural partnerships because some city or community positions itself as embracing competition?
I don't know if it's so much that cities have positioned themselves to do that, but what we have found in connecting this to the entire state is that there is no community in this state that doesn't have some great, rich, competitive story that they love to tell. And whether it's a local sports lore or something else, that everyone across the state seems to really connect to this notion of competition.
How did you, so the exhibition, which is traveling and will be a number of places over the next
2 years.
2 years. How did you figure out how to narrow down? I'm just thinking, you're talking about sports. There have to be so many great basketball stories. You know, the shot that went into the basket at the final 2 seconds, or the town that got on the map because of basketball. How did you narrow down the stories, or how did you pick which stories were best?
Well, as you mentioned, you referenced the exhibit. The exhibit's kind of a key part of this series of programs, and there are numerous components to the exhibit, but one of my favorites is there's a collection of 15 one-minute documentaries on large touchscreens in the exhibit. And selecting those stories was a fun and interesting project that, you're right, we could have gone on forever. I still hear stories. I heard one last week that I couldn't believe that I hadn't heard up to now and would have loved to have thrown it in. But we tried to find really rich, nuanced stories that some people may have been familiar with but weren't cliched or weren't overly utilized. So we intentionally skipped the Milan Miracle. It's a great story.
Get out of my head. That's what I was thinking.
We intentionally skipped the Rudy story. They're all great stories,
but
lots of other people have told them. And so we wanted to find stories that were meaningful and that people would latch onto, but would maybe surprise some people that those came from here, what really happened around that event.
Sure. I'm picturing either a Google document with a grid, or maybe a big old-fashioned chalkboard or whiteboard with categories, social competition, athletic competition, business competition. Is that kind of how you fleshed everything out?
There's a sloppy whiteboard in my office to this day with a lot of that. But we actually took a different path in dividing the content up, because competition, as we've tested this broad concept, we tried to hone on a few elements that we felt like were the real universal human aspects of competition.
Mm-hmm.
So the exhibit we've divided into 5 sections. There's one on civility, rivalry, innovation, passion, and failure.
Mm.
And so those were the categories through which we tried to explore stories and find ones that fit and tied into one component or another.
What's a story of civility? What's a good example of that? I love that category.
It's so we did a few stories in civility. One of them that we did is we went with Abraham Lincoln, but would seem like a cliched, well-told story. But what we wanted to explore here is there's this notion that our political discourse has devolved over time, and that there was a nobler era of our political debates.
Well, you're going to tell us it's not true, aren't you?
We knew how to be. I'm not saying it's not true, but I am saying it would be a mistake to completely idealize any particular time period.
Sure.
And if you look to Lincoln era politics and even Lincoln himself, they were not afraid to roll up their sleeves and get nasty.
Ooh, love it. Well, how timely in this particular election year. So, rivalry?
Rivalry. One of my favorite stories in this exhibit talks about a rivalry between Three Fingers Brown, or Mordecai Brown from Terre Haute, Indiana,
mm-hmm.
and one of his counterparts who played for the New York Giants. And I love this story and couldn't believe I hadn't heard it until we started researching this exhibit. Mordecai Brown was a farm kid from just outside of Terre Haute who played baseball, and he was an average pitcher with a mediocre fastball. And then he got his hand caught in a piece of farm machinery did a lot of serious damage to his hand. And he lost one finger and severely damaged another. But what happened from that is his once his hand healed, his mediocre fastball turned into an unhittable curveball. And he became one of the first great pitchers in Major League Baseball at the turn of the last century. Played for the Cubs and pitched for the Cubs when they won their last World Series.
You know, living here, it's hard not to hear that story and see it through the lens of, and this is such a typical Midwestern way of thinking, we take the lemons and we make them into lemonade.
Absolutely. And what I like about this twist is it's not somebody overcoming adversity so much as the adversity itself becoming their greatest tool.
Becoming their strength, yeah.
I mean, he didn't achieve what he achieved in spite of his injury. He achieved it because of it.
Right. Not that he would ever have intentionally done that. But
I don't recommend that for any young baseball players.
Please don't. Don't get any ideas here. Do you feel like you've discovered, that's a you plural, any way in which Hoosiers do have a different view on competition than maybe folks in neighboring states?
I think that what I have found and what others have found is that we Hoosiers have embraced competition in a very universally American way. That I think we recognize that there are always issues of moderation, but it's something that, for the most part, we embrace and use that to draw out our strengths. And I think I've found that that's a pretty common American trait. And what makes it maybe uniquely Hoosier is that there's a certain dose of humility with that, that we work very hard to compete and to be competitive, but we don't spend a lot of time talking about how competitive we are.
I used to work at the Children's Museum with Peter Sterling, who had come here through a circuitous route from Boston. But Boston was always his litmus test, his model for behavior. And he had the hardest time understanding how we negotiate in Indiana. He said, in Boston, you would have a knockdown, drag-out fight. You would argue, you would yell, you would call each other names. And then you'd shake hands and buy each other a beer. And he said, here, everybody is sometimes so genteel. You feel as though people are afraid to disagree, afraid to compete.
I think that's absolutely the case. And one of the things, both within this exhibit and outside of the exhibit and other programs we do that we want to explore with civility, is that I think there's this general notion that civility means being nice, mm-hmm. trying to avoid disagreement. Mm-hmm. And there are different ways to understand the term, but the way that I read and understand the word civility isn't this fear of confrontation, but is understanding how to do that in a way that elevates the conversation and doesn't make it devolve. That we can disagree and even disagree strongly, but we have to figure out a way to have that conversation that doesn't cause the conversation to stop, that we can still have it and move forward. And I think that's something that, myself included, but we at Hoosiers could maybe get better at, mm-hmm. not being afraid of the confrontation, but understanding how to do it in a healthy and productive way.
And in a way that allows both sides of an argument. See, I almost edited myself to conversation. It's okay to say the A word, argument, but to allow both sides to know, I still respect you. It's okay. I still love you. I still like you. I still want to work with you, but I just disagree. I'm at a polar opposite from you on this particular issue, say.
Absolutely. I mean, the issues of the day and the issues that we've always been debating, we debate them because they're complicated and there are rarely black and white answers.
Right.
And I think it's being willing to have that conversation and understand that somebody who sees this from a different perspective isn't a bad person. You may believe they're wrong, but that doesn't make them a bad person.
Sure.
And I think as soon as we start name-calling as part of that discussion, which seems to be more of the order today, it's hard to continue the conversation when you let it devolve to name-calling and finger-pointing rather than disagreement.
Yeah, then it becomes about the emotion of the lack of civility. So there's an exhibition, but there's a lot of programming. You have programming partners.
Absolutely. And with the exhibit, we had a great partner in the Indiana Historical Society. It's a fabulous institution with great resources, and the people on their staff are amazing. I mean, I have to say that Jeff Mills, Luke Smith, Eloise Scroggins were all really vital core parts of making this exhibit happen. And without them, we certainly couldn't have done it, or it wouldn't have been near the exhibit that it is today. So they were a great partner in helping us put this piece together. And with our other programs, it's we believe that we don't do anything well unless we find other people to hold hands and come down the road with us. Hmm. And so actually, I believe that the day of this program, we'll be doing an event with the Indiana Fever celebrating the 40th anniversary of Title IX, which occurs this month.
For anybody who doesn't know what Title IX was.
Title IX was the legislation that mandated all academic institutions that receive federal funding provide equal opportunities for both men and women. And it was...
It was late. 40 years ago is still fairly new for that. It was late in coming, but it finally happened.
Absolutely. And I think that what we found in looking at this is there's been a pretty dramatic and fast sea change across the nation because of Title IX. I mean, part of the discussions that we're having when we have Title IX discussions in an intergenerational way, I mean, there are a generation of women in their 20s and younger who can't even fathom the idea that my school would have a men's soccer team but not a women's soccer team,
right,
or that there would be scholarships available for men to do this but not for women. I mean, the notion of that seems so foreign to them, but yet a generation or two earlier, and they know that scenario all too well.
Sharon Gamble with Indiana Humanities Program Director Brandon Judkins. You can see the Spirit of Competition touring exhibition at the JCC through June 29th. Then from July 2nd through the 12th, it will be at Bankers Life Fieldhouse. And July 13th through the 22nd, it will be at the Black Expo Summer Celebration. More dates and programming and all sorts of other information can be found at indianahumanities.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 when I chat with author, yes, author, Ken Beckley about his new book.
Well, it's a very literary show, as I'll be talking with author Jonathan Jans about his book, House of Skin.
Ooh, creepy. I'll wrap it up with a look at what the Ensemble Music Society has planned for this new season. Plus, there'll be our arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.